Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer.
Hi there. Thanks a lot for joining me for today's show. I really do appreciate it. Hope you're having a great Memorial Day weekend. Lots to talk about today, including new guidelines for resuming youth and high school sports in the St. Louis area. We'll also talk about hydroxychloroquine and get some tips on how to enjoy a safe and healthy Memorial Day weekend. But first, let's start the way we always do with our co-host, Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, thanks a lot for joining us again.
My pleasure.
Wanted to bring up with you some new findings from the CDC. First, we've got some new CDC numbers on the mortality rate for COVID-19. It's 0.4%. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that seems in line with what I think most people kind of thought. When we first started hearing about this, the concern was a 2% fatality rate. And mortality rate is always the number of people that pass divided by the number of people that have the disease. It's a simple fraction. The issue with all that is always figuring out what the denominator, the lower number, is. And, as we find out, there's a lot of asymptomatic carriers of this disease, which gives you a larger denominator. You just don't know about it. And as we've, honed our models and our testing and started to get a better idea of the scope and nature of this, that number going down is not a surprise. And it's consistent with most other viral infections, maybe a little bit more than others, but seems a more reasonable number. And I can't remember the fatality rate of the flu. I think it's about 0.1%. It's lower than that. So, COVID still may be more fatal than some of the more common things we see, but not that 2%, which is a shockingly high number. So that's good to see.
And 35% of coronavirus infections are asymptomatic, according to the CDC.
Yeah, I think that's a powerful number. And I think those estimates have varied quite a bit. And it's, that seems kind of in line with what makes some sense with based on previous experience. But, I think there's probably, that still is quite a guesstimate. And there's probably a pretty broad range of that number. I mean, it could be much higher. It could be a little bit lower.
The CDC also has some new findings or advice on transmission of the virus. It says it does not survive well on surfaces and objects, mainly spread by physical exposure. What do we do with that information?
Yeah, and again, I think this goes along with what we know about other viruses of the species. Coronavirus is typically a respiratory pathogen and distributed by, respiratory spread. So breathing, coughing, sneezing, anything that can come out of your mouth and nostrils. There's lots of good studies now that have shown that it does survive on surfaces to varying lengths. But there's a couple key principles of getting infected. It's not even just being exposed to the virus. That's the first part. You have to be exposed in order to get an infection. The second important component is just how much of the viral particles you're getting. So there's certainly a higher concentration in respiratory spread than, something on the surface. And if you think about it, if you have, say, let's just say a keyboard that somebody coughed on. So there's virus on your keyboard. You're touching with your fingers. And then somehow the fingers have to bring your fingers to your face and inoculate enough of that from the keyboard to your fingers, to your mouth at a high concentration to get you sick. And that there's just kind of more steps in that process for that to really kind of transmit an effective dose. Is it possible? Sure. It just probably is not the most common way this is spread. It seems very clear now that this is certainly the usual suspects, sneezing, coughing, et cetera. But as we've talked before, the breathing, kind of a prolonged contact in a poorly ventilated area where somebody may even have asymptomatic carrier that's just breathing. And if you've been in that environment for a long amount of time, that certainly probably provides enough inoculation or exposure to the proper number of viruses to get you sick. And that seems to be the case. And again, big examples are the church in South Korea, where there's a couple of people sick. They got pretty much everybody in that congregation sick. The soccer match in Italy, in Milan, that who knows how many people were sick, but that seems to be the nidus for the massive outbreak in Milan. Those are the types of environments where this kind of really spreads like wildfire.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, I'm hearing about COVID-19 causing delirium in some patients. What are you seeing?
Yeah, this doesn't shock at all. And I think it kind of goes back to the same thing with the respiratory complications we talked about briefly yesterday is, again, when people are in the ICU, not only, again, even if you don't have that ventilator to help you breathe, you're in a very confusing environment. Night becomes day and day becomes night. You're on a lot of medicines, either to keep your blood pressure up, give antibiotics, you're giving medicines to kind of calm you down. And, there's bells and whistles and commotion. It's a very busy kind of complex place, and it can be disorienting to people when they're ill. And illness itself creates disorientation. And the medical word for this is delirium. And so that's all part of ICU care. It's it's very, very common just by itself. And then, you add a kind of a novel disease like COVID that's shown a lot of secondary effects. And, certainly the fact that it causes delirium is not surprising. The million-dollar question behind all this is it due to COVID? Is it due to the ICU? Is it due to, severe illness or some combination thereof? And, that's probably the right answer. And so it's certainly something that's possible, certainly something that we see. Certainly something that when you have delirium, your outcomes tend to be a little bit worse. And frankly, recovery is afterwards. There's good studies that show that when you have delirium in the ICU, if you recover and you get out of the ICU and you eventually get back to your normal state of health, your cognitive ability will have declined compared to where you were before getting ill. And that's not just in COVID. That's in really more in anybody that has this concept of delirium in a hospital. And so it just shows all these kind of long-term consequences to expect out of this eventually as a result of this pandemic. I mean, it's going to be kind of, we talk a lot about mortality, which is people dying from the disease, but there's also this concept of morbidity, which is, complications from the disease afterwards that we still have to provide care for. People will need rehab and therapy and all these different things to try to get them back to a functional status. And it's going to take time for a lot of people.
Dr. Fred Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up next, we'll get some tips on how to have a safe and healthy Memorial Day weekend. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer.
Every day we seem to be learning something new about this novel coronavirus called COVID-19 and how we can best protect ourselves. Wanted to talk about that with Dr. Jason Newland. Dr. Newland is a Washington University infectious diseases specialist at St. Louis Children's Hospital. Dr. Newland, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Fred. Glad to be here.
Dr. Newland, what advice do you have for us with so many things reopening this past week in the St. Louis area? Salons, restaurants, offices. What do we need to know to stay safe?
Fred, the things we have to do to stay safe is the same things we've been doing. Number one, we got to social distance. We can go out now and there's more places open, but we still recommend social distancing. Number two, we still need to remember about washing our hands, washing them effectively, making sure that we're using soap and water or 60% alcohol. We rub all the surfaces, including in between our fingers and our thumbs. Number three, avoiding touching our face. And number four, I highly recommend you wear a mask if you can't social distance. That can be a cloth-based mask. These sorts of things will keep us protected, and I think we should be doing that at this point in time.
Are there certain places you think we should avoid to be extra safe?
To be extra safe, you avoid places that are going to be gatherings, right? This virus, it's important to know that this virus spreads by people. And that people don't have to be sick. They can just have, you know, be talking, and that could have virus that could spread. And so doing things like wearing the mask, washing your hands, and avoiding these areas that there's more gathering is, I think, a big key.
And with the long Memorial Day weekend here, what do we need to keep in mind?
The Memorial Day weekend is such a great holiday. The main things we need to do is, number one, do the practices that we've been doing. And I know people are going to want to go out and spend time with their loved ones and some friends. I think we have to limit the gatherings. It's okay now to start talking about maybe expanding our circle. But we have to remember that there is risk when we start being around more people. I think if we know that our loved ones and family have been, you know, doing the same social distancing practices, not going out and doing the stay at home order, I think they're going to be safe to be around. Though, again, anytime we start getting in bigger groups, there is some risk to that.
Is it okay to go on a short road trip?
Yes, it is okay to go on a short road trip. The things to remember are still social distancing, washing your hands. I'd wear a mask when it's hard to social distance or when you're going to be in a little bit more groups of people. And also just being mindful of, you know, wiping down surfaces if need be and not touching your face.
What about a barbecue with friends?
I love barbecues. I think we all want to do the barbecues. I think these friends that are close friends that, you know, have been doing the social distancing practices and doing the things that you have been doing to prevent yourself from getting the virus, I think it's okay. But I wouldn't be talking about a large group. It might be one or two friends in a smaller group that will practice some of this distancing and do some things together. I think it's probably okay at this point.
We're talking with Dr. Jason Newland. Dr. Newland is a Washington University infectious diseases specialist at St. Louis Children's Hospital. Dr. Newland, the CDC now says that coronavirus or COVID-19 does not seem to survive well on surfaces or objects. With that in mind, what do you think about wearing gloves when we shop or wiping down all of our food once we buy it?
I don't think you have to wear gloves when you shop. I don't think you have to wipe down the food. But what I would tell you is important to remember is that the primary reason this virus is spread is people. We do know that the virus could be on a surface. While it might not live as long as we initially thought, you could potentially touch a surface that has a lot of virus and then touch your face and get the virus. So the key is still to wash your hands effectively. Doing that will help, as well as wiping down some of these surfaces that potentially are a place that there could be a lot of stuff on it. And I think that's still the way to go at this point.
Any other tips we need to keep in mind?
I think the biggest tips, I'm going to stress, social distance when you can. Wear a mask out there in public when that social distance is going to be harder. And I think that we need to be just kind of getting used to that for the time being. Number three would be avoid touching your face. And number four, let's just remember to work together and know that we're all in this together. And by working together, we're going to get through this much quicker than if we don't.
Dr. Newland, thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate it.
Hey, Fred, I appreciate you, man. You guys are doing great work. So thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Jason Newland is a Washington University infectious diseases specialist at St. Louis Children's Hospital. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at hydroxychloroquine and the controversy surrounding this drug. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer.
President Trump has now wrapped up a two-week regimen of taking the drug hydroxychloroquine as a possible preventive measure against COVID-19. Here's how we found out about that on Monday during a news conference.
The frontline workers, many, many are taking it. I happen to be taking it.
Hydroxychloroquine?
I'm taking it. Hydroxychloroquine.
When?
Right now, yeah. A couple of weeks ago, I started taking it. Because I think it's good. I've heard a lot of good stories. And if it's not good, I'll tell you right, I'm not going to get hurt by it. It's been around for 40 years for malaria, for lupus, for other things. I take it. Frontline workers take it. A lot of doctors take it. I take it.
Let's talk with SLU care cardiologist Dr. Michael Lim at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital about those comments. Dr. Lim, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Fred.
Dr. Lim, what's your reaction to President Trump saying he's taking hydroxychloroquine as a preventive measure?
So this was obviously something that gained a lot of notoriety because this medication was talked about several weeks ago as a medication that could potentially be used to treat patients who are actively infected with coronavirus or COVID-19. So obviously this brings up a question saying, well, does the president actually have the virus? The news reports from the White House says that he tested negative. So then the next thing is there a reasonable assumption or a thought that taking this medication could prevent you from getting the virus? Which obviously, if this worked, would be fantastic, and all of us should consider being on it. The real deal is that there are some observations from Europe that maybe people who take this medication chronically don't get infected with COVID, but it hasn't been proven. So there's no actual scientific fact that backs up what the president is doing. He's kind of doing this off the cuff and basically a gut decision is saying, I don't think there's a downside and I'm going to take this. Now, this is completely contrary to what we're, I think, supposed to do in the medical community, whereas we are supposed to ask the questions, look at the evidence that supports what are the potential benefits, and then weigh those against what the downsides are in a medication or any kind of treatment. So if we walk through the president's decision, the upside in terms of what the potential benefits are not proven and theoretical at best at this moment. The downsides are that the medication actually can predispose you to a heart rhythm problem, which could actually be lethal and you could die from it. So when you make that trade or that balancing discussion of, well, does the pros outweigh the cons, in this situation, I would advise the absolute answer to that is no. There are only theoretic pros. There are definite cons, and we would not recommend this for patients, regardless of whether you're president of the United States, whether you're president of a company, or you're president of your own household, or not even president. This is not something that should be recommended for the general public.
Dr. Lim, can you walk us through the previous trials of chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine when it comes to COVID-19?
So originally there was a study that was done in a small number of patients in France that looked at giving patients with severe COVID infections hydroxychloroquine. And a couple of them may have gotten a little bit better. And I'm not trying to underplay the results here, but there was no solid sign that said the hydroxychloroquine made the infection go away quicker or help people survive more. But that was the only study out there in terms of any kind of active treatment, and so that's why it gained notoriety. The study that I referred to in terms of hydroxychloroquine potentially preventing COVID infection, these were observations that were made by Italian physicians when Italy was ravaged by the COVID virus, where they sitting around kind of talking about who they see and who they don't see, they basically didn't see anybody who was COVID positive who had been on this medication. And so that entered into a concept of wonderment, of I wonder whether there is a way in which this medication might prevent us or anybody from becoming actively infected. That's far from actual proof that that actually works. That's an observation which we would call a hypothesis that needs to be tested. The best test would be to take a large number of people, randomize them, which is basically flipping a coin. If the coin comes up heads, you get the active medication. The coin comes up tails, you get a placebo or a fake medication. You don't know whether you got the real thing or not. And then you follow that person for a period of time, and they theoretically would get exposed to COVID. And you see whether there's a smaller number of people on active treatment that developed active COVID infections. That would be more positive proof and scientific evidence that this would actually work.
And again, tell us the dangers of this drug.
The biggest danger is a heart danger, where the heart is basically an engine that has to beat, and so it has electrical timing to it. And the medication changes the electrical timing to a point where it actually predisposes it to go into a bad heart rhythm, that bad heart rhythm being ventricular tachycardia, which is a really rapid heart rate from the bottom chambers of the heart, which quickly degenerates into something called ventricular fibrillation, which is basically just a fasciculations of the heart, which aren't really a squeeze or a pump, and lead to death if not treated rapidly in a hospital or by EMS.
Dr. Lim, thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Take care, and let's keep hoping that we get through this at some point in time.
Dr. Michael Lim is a slew care cardiologist at SSM Health, St. Louis University Hospital. Now, let's talk with Dr. Michael Avedon. Dr. Avedon is the head of the Department of Anesthesiology at Washington University School of Medicine. He's also one of the principal investigators of a new trial centered here at WashU that's testing chloroquine as a way to protect health workers from COVID-19. Dr. Avedon, thanks for joining us.
You're most welcome.
So tell me about this new study underway at Washington University School of Medicine.
Our focus is really to look at the period before exposure and around the time when people are exposed and early disease. And I'll tell you why this is really important, because a lot of therapies have focused on trying to treat people when they're already severely ill with COVID-19 disease. We're currently putting most of our efforts into treatment and research when people already have severe disease. And from my perspective, that's tantamount to closing the stable door after the horse has already bolted. If you want to really make a big impact on COVID-19, we need to shift our focus to trying to get promising agents to people before they're exposed, at the time they're exposed, and when they have very, very early disease. And that's what our research platform is focused on. And the first drug that we're choosing to test on that platform is a drug called chloroquine, but we're hoping to test other drugs as well, because as a research platform, we're designed to rapidly test and evaluate drugs, and if they're promising, to figure that out and then to be able to roll them out, and if they're not promising, to be able to move on to other therapeutic agents.
Who will you be testing this on?
So we are going to be inviting healthcare workers all around the world. So we're based on four continents, including countries in Africa, in Europe, in North America, and South America, involved as investigators. And we're hoping that healthcare workers in these countries will be enthusiastic to participate in this research. The reason why we think it's important to include healthcare workers is because, if you think about it, healthcare workers are incredibly vulnerable, because we as healthcare workers are often exposed to those who are infected with SARS coronavirus 2. And in fact, healthcare workers have often had severe manifestations of the disease. And this might be because when we're exposed, we get a big, high amount of virus transferred from very sick patients to us.
How will you recruit local healthcare workers?
So we're very proud to have a major presence here in St. Louis, Missouri. We'll be partnering with our BJC organizations, but we'll also be inviting healthcare workers who work in other healthcare institutions in and around St. Louis, in southern Illinois and in Missouri. We will be appealing to healthcare workers who feel that they are at high risk based on where they work. Maybe it's in the emergency department, maybe it's in an intensive care unit, maybe it's in an extended care facility where there is a high risk for COVID-19. Healthcare workers will enroll by going to our website, which is www.crowncoronation.com. And there they will take a questionnaire, and it will determine their eligibility, and they can sign an online consent form, which will allow them to enroll in the trial. And then if they do decide to participate, then they will receive a study kit with all the things needed for them to participate in this exciting trial, including the medications, including the kits needed for nasal swab taking, and including the kits needed to take a blood specimen from a pinprick on their fingers. This is called a remote clinical trial, where the trial is conducted mostly through use of technology and interface with smartphones and computers, rather than physical contact with members of the research team.
What makes you think chloroquine would be a good candidate for this?
So I think that there are several reasons why chloroquine is likely to be a good candidate, and also several reasons why it may not have been successful in previous studies. Most of the studies that have been done have looked at chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine and other treatments at advanced stages of the disease, where it's really difficult to make progress. So, for example, once you're treating a couple of weeks after symptoms have already started, that's when your body is shutting down, all of your organs are failing. What I'm excited about and optimistic about in relation to this trial is we're starting the therapy and continuing it for 3 months, hopefully prior to exposure and around the time of exposure. And chloroquine works in several different ways that have been established in the laboratory, in animals, and even in human studies. So chloroquine prevents the entry of the virus into human cells in the first place. When the SARS coronavirus 2 gets into human cells, chloroquine decreases the replication of the virus. Chloroquine has also been shown to treat a condition called pulmonary hypertension, which is high blood pressure of the blood vessels in the lungs, which is one of the problems that occurs with COVID-19. Chloroquine has also been shown in some studies to help treat pneumonia, and chloroquine might also help some of the harmful immune responses of the body to COVID-19. So I'm not saying I know for sure that chloroquine works. If I knew for sure, then we wouldn't need to do the trial. But I think that we really need high quality science with big trials conducted all around the world to answer questions about whether promising drugs like chloroquine given early and given over the appropriate period of time can prevent people from becoming ill with COVID-19. So our trial is designed in the way to answer the question at the right time, so prior to infection, for the right duration, so given over a 3-month period, and to the right people, to healthcare workers who are at risk for this infection and who can derive specific benefit from their involvement.
Dr. Avedon, if this works as a preventive measure, could it be used in consideration for some sort of a vaccine?
It cannot be used as a vaccine because a vaccine is an entirely different technology. And I think it's important that we pursue the different scientific strands in parallel. We're faced here with a pandemic, and all of us around the world should be collaborating, uniting our efforts, because when any therapy wins, all of us in humanity win. So everybody, I want to make this clear, we should all be rooting for the success of every scientific experiment that is going on in relation to COVID-19. This isn't a competition. This is the biggest international collaboration that you can imagine. I am rooting for every scientist to be successful, because when a vaccine works, then my family and I will be safer. So this, if this works, I think what is likely is that this will work in combination with other therapies. So we need to find out which is the best cocktail of drugs that best works at preventing and treating COVID-19. So my suspicion is that if chloroquine works, it'll have some efficacy, and then combining it with other drugs that also seem to be promising might have a big effect.
Dr. Avedon, thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate it.
Likewise. Thank you.
Dr. Michael Avedon is the head of the Department of Anesthesiology at Washington University School of Medicine. He's also one of the principal investigators of that new global study underway now at WashU. When we come back, we'll talk about some new guidelines for restarting youth and high school sports in the St. Louis area. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters on KMOX.
Welcome back to Health Matters with Fred Bottomer.
We now have a date for when youth and high school sports activity might be able to resume across the St. Louis area. It's June 15th if everything goes well, according to new guidelines put out by the area's biggest healthcare systems. We're talking about BJC Healthcare at Washington University Physicians, Mercy, and SSM Health's Slough Care. Here to talk with us about these new guidelines is Katie Smith. Katie is the Sports Medicine Outreach Manager at SSM Health. Katie, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
So tell us about these new guidelines being offered for youth and high school sports.
Yeah, so recently SSM Health collaborated with BJC Healthcare and Mercy really to provide some guidelines and framework for what we call resocialization of both youth and high school sports in the St. Louis region. And so really that specifically speaks to recommendations surrounding returning to sports. And so we call it resocialization based off of the CDC guidelines because reality is it's more about the entire concept surrounding sports rather than just the activity of sports themselves. It's really pretty complicated when we look at sort of getting back into what our new normal is going to be in regards to sports. And that's really what these guidelines are. It's really a roadmap, hopefully, for organizations and coaches and schools to try to ease back into a very phased approach into sports.
Hit some of the highlights of these guidelines.
Yeah, so the really big thing to remember about these guidelines is it's multi-part. So the first part of the recommendations are some basic guidelines to follow in how we approach sports. So simple things like screenings prior to any sort of activity of any kind is probably the biggest recommendation that we're giving, and that you'll see that in many different sets of guidelines, both by counties and cities everywhere, we talk about employee health screenings, and that's important, but we also need to be screening these kids because they're going to potentially be in very close contact in some of these phases. And so we need to be screening them for, first off, their signs and symptoms to basically report if they've had any COVID-19 similar symptoms, as well as checking for a fever. That's really imperative to make sure that we're screening kids negative before they do participate. And then what we've basically done is we've created two categories. So we have a high frequency of contact sports, which has sports like basketball, football, soccer, things where we have a high frequency of coming in contact with one another. And then there's a low frequency phase. So things that are more individual in nature, things like gymnastics, things like weightlifting, golf, that realistically there's very little contact. But there's a phased approach for each of these. So high contact sports have four different phases, and low frequency sports have three different phases. And both of them start about the same time. So what our current recommendation is that as long as in the county that you reside, that there is still continued either stable or continued downward trajectory of COVID-19 cases in your region for a minimum of 14 days straight, then we're recommending that about June 15th is the recommended start date for both youth and high school athletics in the region. And again, that's basically as long as we get that continued downward trajectory. That's really the key here. And then each phase is based on that same gating criteria, and that's set by the CDC. So we want to see 2 weeks consistently of a downward trajectory of those cases, and then we can kind of move into the next phase. And the first phase is very simple. It's really 10 or less individuals in a space, and we're limiting that contact as much as possible and really encouraging social distancing, but while doing some type of activity at the same time. And then the phases really increase from there. Our goal is that if we are able to continue to see these downward trajectory of cases, that we will be able to move through those phases as well. We don't know, which is why that gating criteria is really important, is that we don't want to see these outbreak in cases or these spikes in cases as we really reopen our region. It's important to understand that piece of it, and we're really here to help guide organizations through that.
Katie, what do the guidelines say about the use of locker rooms or allowing spectators at the games?
So use of locker rooms is really not recommended at this time. Realistically, we want to encourage as much social distancing outside of that direct contact that has to occur in some of those phases. We really don't want them using those locker rooms or really any type of common area. Because one of the other things that's recommended is that we also separate and have changes about the amount of time in between activities and really spread out practices and games so that there's limited or no interaction between these different groups of sports or teams. And so locker room really encourages them to be in a very close space. So we don't encourage that. If you have a big enough locker room that you can social distance and separate, let's say, every three lockers or so, so they don't really have to have any interaction, that's okay. But for the most part, we really want to not use those common areas. In addition, we really don't want spectators in most of these phases as well. When we get into game or competition phases, some spectators are realistically probably going to be allowed. But we really want to limit that because the reality is that our concern is much higher for our spectators than it is our kids, realistically. Kids, what we're seeing right now is they have a much higher immunity and they handle COVID-19 much better than adults. And our concern is that, yes, kids can bring this home to their families, but also having spectators in close quarters is much more likely to lead to an outbreak in cases, really even more than the kids. So we really want to limit that in the practice scenario. If kids are old enough to get out of the car, be screened themselves, we really encourage more of a carpool line to eliminate all of that extra parent interaction during these activities.
What about a common practice of sharing water bottles?
So that's another really big and simple thing that we're encouraging teams to do is to encourage their athletes to bring their own individual water bottle labels and to eliminate things like the use of a cooler if possible. If a cooler has to be used, it should be one cooler per team or per group. Really limiting use of things like water fountains. If you have a water fountain, we would prefer if you had a no-touch refill station so that you're having as much or as little contact with the same things over and over. Things like bathrooms should still be used, but if we can encourage additional uses of other restrooms, so we're not all using one restroom, that's also encouraged. And if they are using those restrooms, that we're limiting the number of people coming and going at that same time to limit the chance of transmission in that scenario as well. Really trying to eliminate the use of cups, the use of things like cubbies in a lot of organizations or break rooms or common areas, and really limiting the entrances and exits to facilities, especially indoor facilities. That's much more concerning. Outdoor facilities, it's a little bit easier to manage that. But really limiting the amount of people that are coming in and out. And then every individual that is coming in and out needs to be screened as well.
We're talking with Katie Smith. Katie is the Sports Medicine Outreach Manager at SSM Health. Katie, what about handshakes and fist bumps?
So I think that realistically, any type of handshakes, high fives, fist bumps, even those team huddles are really going to be something that's going to be eliminated for quite some time. I think really when people read these guidelines, our hope is to help people understand what our version of our new normal is. Those are things that realistically it is going to not be something that we're going to recommend for a really long time. Until this is something that we're no longer dealing with on a regular basis, we really can't do that. The transmission rate is just simply too high in those. And so much of this phased approach is also helping kids to start to understand that. We realize that kids have been high-fiving each other and fist-bumping each other and giving each other hugs for a long time. And so we really have to start to break some of those habits if we're going to allow them to return. And it's really important that our coaches and our administrators and our officials and parents really help kids to understand that and educate them on the importance of that so that they hopefully can help follow some of these guidelines to limit the number of outbreaks and increase transmission rates that we're going to start to see realistically.
Katie, what's the guideline on who should wear masks?
So really, any individuals who are in public of any kind that are not able to social distance of a minimum of 6 feet and are not engaged in vigorous physical activity should really be in a mask. So that includes any spectators at any of these events. That includes parents dropping off their children. And really, it involves the kids who are participating in sport up until the time that they are participating in a vigorous activity. So we don't want kids in a mask who are running around and doing a high amount of intense activity. But while they're in line being screened, while they're waiting for their workout or practice to begin, they can certainly be wearing those. Also, while they're sitting on a bench or having a team meeting, they can have them on. Really, coaches should have them on the entire time. That's very important as they are likely carriers of this as well. So any individuals that they're really around and when you're not doing that activity, they really do need to have that mask on. And again, that's going to be part of our norm for quite some time. So getting kids used to this idea of having the mask on and that it's not scary, that doesn't mean that you're necessarily sick, but it's a protection for others around you as well as yourself.
Katie Smith is the Sports Medicine Outreach Manager at SSM Health. And that's all the time we have for today's show. Thanks so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. If you want to hear parts of this show again, please log on to KMOX.com and look under the podcast section. Or you can download the radio.com app and favorite KMOX. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join us again next week at the same time for another edition of Health Matters on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.